From deep in the acoustical horn, the old woman's voice came out to them, an amplified whisper, harsh and penetrating.
"Cheney has returned from her Hajra. Cheney has seen the waters."
A susurrant response arose from the crowd. "She has seen the waters."
"I consecrate the daughter of Liet in the Sayadina," husked the old woman. "She is accepted," the crowd responded.
Paul barely heard the ceremony, his attention still centred on what had been said of his mother. If she should fail? He turned and looked back at the one they called Reverend Mother, studying the dried crone features, the fathomless blue fixation of her eyes. She looked as though a breeze would blow her away, yet there was that about her which suggested she might stand untouched in the path of a Coriolis storm. She carried the same aura of power that he remembered from the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam, who had tested him with agony in the way of the Gorm Jabbar.
"I, the Reverend Mother Ramallo, whose voice speaks as a multitude, say this to you," the old woman said. "It is fitting that Cheney enter this Sayadina."
"It is fitting," the crowd responded. The old woman nodded, whispered,
"I give her the silver skies, the golden desert and its shining rocks, the green fields that will be. I give these to Sayadina Cheney, and lest she forget that she's servant of us all, to her fall the menial tasks in this ceremony of the seed. Let it be as Shaihulud will have it."
She lifted a brown stick arm, dropped it. Jessica, feeling the ceremony close around her with a current that swept her beyond all turning back, glanced once at Paul's question-filled face, then prepared herself for the ordeal.
"Let the water masters come forward," Cheney said, with only the slightest quaver of uncertainty in her girl-child voice.
Now Jessica felt herself at the focus of danger, knowing its presence in the watchfulness of the throng, in the silence. A band of men made its way through a serpentine path opened in the crowd, moving up from the back in pairs. Each pair carried a small skin sack, perhaps twice the size of a human head. The sacks sloshed heavily. The two leaders deposited their load at Cheney's feet on the ledge and stepped back. Jessica looked at the sack, then at the men. They had their hoods thrown back, exposing long hair tied in a roll at the base of the neck. The black pits of their eyes stared back at her without wavering. A furry redolence of cinnamon arose from the sack, wafted across Jessica. The spice? She wondered.
"Is there water?"
Cheney asked. The watermaster on the left, a man with a purple scar line across the bridge of his nose, nodded once.
"There is water, Sayadina," he said, "but we cannot drink of it."
"Is there seed?" Cheney asked.
"There is seed," the man said.
Cheney knelt and put her hands to the sloshing sack.
"Blessed is the water and its seed."
There was familiarity to the rite, and Jessica looked back at the Reverend Mother Ramallo. The old woman's eyes were closed, and she sat hunched over as though asleep.
"Sayadina Jessica," Cheney said.
Jessica turned to see the girl staring up at her.
"Have you tasted the blessed water?"
Cheney asked. Before Jessica could answer, Cheney said,
"It is not possible that you have tasted the blessed water. You are outworlder and unprivileged."
A sigh passed through the crowd, a susurration of robes that made the nape hairs creep on Jessica's neck.
"The crop was large, and the maker has been destroyed," Cheney said.
She began unfastening a coiled spout fixed to the top of the sloshing bag. Now Jessica felt the sense of danger boiling around her. She glanced at Paul, saw that he was caught up in the mystery of the ritual and had eyes only for Cheney.
"Has he seen this moment in time?"
Jessica wondered. She rested a hand on her abdomen, thinking of the unborn daughter there, asking herself, "Do I have the right to risk us both?" Chaney lifted the spout toward Jessica, said,
"Here is the water of life, the water that is greater than water can, the water that frees the soul. If you be a reverend mother, it opens the universe to you. Let Shai Hulud judge now."
Jessica felt herself torn between duty to her unborn child and duty to Paul. For Paul, she knew, she should take that spout and drink of the sack's contents, but as she bent to the proffered spout, her senses told her its peril. The stuff in the sack had a bitter smell, subtly akin to many poisons that she knew, but unlike them, too.
"You must drink it now," Janie said.
"There's no turning back," Jessica reminded herself. But nothing in all her Bene Gesserit training came into her mind to help her through this instant.
"What is it?"
Jessica asked herself.
"A liquor? A drug?"
She bent over the spout, smelling the esters of cinnamon, remembering then the drunkenness of Duncan, Idaho.
"Spice liquor?"
she asked herself. She took the siphon tube in her mouth, pulled up only the most minuscule sip. It tasted of the spice, a faint bite acrid on the tongue. Janie pressed down on the skin bag. A great gulp of the stuff surged into Jessica's mouth, and before she could help herself, she swallowed it, fighting to retain her calmness and dignity.
"To accept a little death is worse than death itself,"
Janie said. She stared at Jessica, waiting. And Jessica stared back, still holding the spout in her mouth. She tasted the sack's contents in her nostrils, in the roof of her mouth, in her cheeks, in her eyes, a biting sweetness now.
"Cool."
Again, Chaney sent the liquid gushing into Jessica's mouth.
"Delicate."
Jessica studied Chaney's face, elfin features, seeing the traces of Liet Kynes there as yet unfixed by time.
"This is a drug they feed me,"
Jessica told herself. But it was unlike any other drug of her experience, and Bene Gesserit training included the taste of many drugs. Janie's features were so clear, as though outlined in light.
A drug.
Whirling silence settled around Jessica. Every fiber of her body accepted the fact that something profound had happened to it. She felt that she was a conscious mote, smaller than any subatomic particle, yet capable of motion and of sensing her surroundings. Like an abrupt revelation, the curtains whipped away, she realized she had become aware of a psychokinesthetic extension of herself. She was the mote, yet not the mote. The cavern remained around her. The people. She sensed them. Paul, Chaney, Stilgar, the Reverend Mother Amalo.
Reverend Mother?
At the school there had been rumors that some did not survive the Reverend Mother ordeal, that the drug took them. Jessica focused her attention on the Reverend Mother Amalo, aware now that all this was happening in a frozen instant of time, suspended time for her alone.
"Why is time suspended?"
she asked herself. She stared at the frozen expressions around her, seeing a dust mote above Chaney's head, stopped there, waiting. The answer to this instant came like an explosion in her consciousness. Her personal time was suspended to save her life. She focused on the psychokinesthetic extension of herself, looking within, and was confronted immediately with a cellular core, a pit of blackness from which she recoiled.
"That is the place where we cannot look," she thought.
"There is the place the Reverend Mothers are so reluctant to mention. The place where only Kwisatz Haderach may look." This realization returned a small measure of confidence, and again, she ventured to focus on the psychokinesthetic extension, becoming a mote self that searched within her for danger. She found it within the drug she had swallowed. The stuff was dancing particles within her, its motions so rapid that even frozen time could not stop them. Dancing particles. She began recognizing familiar structures, atomic linkages, a carbon atom here, helical wavering, a glucose molecule. An entire chain of molecules confronted her, and she recognized a protein, a methyl protein configuration. Ah! It was a soundless mental sigh within her as she saw the nature of the poison. With her psychokinesthetic probing, she moved into it, shifted an oxygen moat, allowed another carbon moat to link, reattached a linkage of oxygen, hydrogen. The change spread, faster and faster as the catalyzed reaction opened its surface of contact. The suspension of time relaxed its hold upon her, and she sensed motion. The tube spout from the sack was touched to her mouth gently, collecting a drop of moisture. Cheney's taking the catalyst from my body to change the poison in that sack, Jessica thought. Why? Someone eased her to a sitting position. She saw the old Reverend Mother Romalo being brought to sit beside her on the carpeted ledge. A dry hand touched her neck. And there was another psychokinesthetic moat within her awareness. Jessica tried to reject it, but the moat swept closer, closer. They touched. It was like an ultimate simpatico, being two people at once. Not telepathy, but mutual awareness. With the old Reverend Mother. But Jessica saw that the Reverend Mother didn't think of herself as old. An image unfolded before the mutual mind's eye. A young girl with a dancing spirit and tender humor. Within the mutual awareness, the young girl spoke.
Yes, that is how I am.
Jessica could only accept the words, not respond to them.
You'll have it all soon, Jessica.
This is hallucination, Jessica told herself.
You know better than that. Swiftly now, do not fight me. There isn't much time. You should have told us you were pregnant.
Jessica found the voice that talked within the mutual awareness.
Why?
This changes both of you. Holy Mother, what have we done?
Jessica sensed a forced shift in the mutual awareness, saw another mote presence with the inward eye. The other mote darted wildly here, there, circling. It radiated pure terror.
You'll have to be strong. Be thankful it's a daughter you carry. This would have killed a male fetus. Now, carefully, gently, touch your daughter presence. Be your daughter presence. Absorb the fear. Soothe. Use your courage and your strength. Gently now. Gently.
The other whirling mote swept near, and Jessica compelled herself to touch it. Terror threatened to overwhelm her. She fought it the only way she knew. I shall not fear. Fear is the mind killer. The litany brought a semblance of calm. The other mote lay quiescent against her. Words won't work, Jessica told herself. She reduced herself to basic emotional reactions, radiated love, comfort, a warm snuggling of protection. The terror receded. Again, the presence of the old Reverend Mother asserted itself, but now there was a tripling of mutual awareness, two active and one that lay quietly absorbing.
Time compels me. I have much to give you. And I do not know if your daughter can accept all this while remaining sane. But it must be. The needs of the tribe are paramount.
What?
Remain silent and accept.
Experiences began to unroll before Jessica. It was like a lecture strip in a subliminal training projector at the Bene Gesserit school, but faster. Blindingly faster. Yet distinct. She knew each experience as it happened. There was a lover, virile, bearded, with the Fremen eyes, and Jessica saw his strength and tenderness, all of him in one blink moment, through the Reverend Mother's memory. There was no time now to think of what this might be doing to the daughter fetus, only time to accept and record. The experiences poured in on Jessica, birth, life, death, important matters and unimportant, an outpouring of single view time. Why should a fall of sand from a cliff top stick in the memory? She asked herself. Too late, Jessica saw what was happening. The old woman was dying, and, in dying, pouring her experiences into Jessica's awareness as water is poured into a cup. The other mote faded back into pre-birth awareness as Jessica watched it. And, dying in conception, the old Reverend Mother left her life in Jessica's memory with one last sighing blur of words.
I've been a long time waiting for you. Here is my life.
There it was, encapsulated, all of it, even the moment of death. I am now a Reverend Mother, Jessica realized. And she knew with a generalized awareness that she had become, in truth, precisely what was meant by a Bene Gesserit Reverend Mother. The poison drug had transformed her. This wasn't exactly how they did it at the Bene Gesserit school, she knew. No one had ever introduced her to the mysteries of it, but she knew. The end result was the same. Jessica sensed the daughter mote still touching her inner awareness, probed it without response. A terrible sense of loneliness crept through Jessica in the realization of what had happened to her. She saw her own life as a pattern that had slowed, and all life around her speeded up so that the dancing interplay became clearer. The sensation of mote awareness faded slightly, its intensity easing as her body relaxed from the threat of the poison, but still she felt that other mote, touching it with a sense of guilt at what she had allowed to happen to it. I did it, my poor, unformed, dear little daughter. I brought you into this universe and exposed your awareness to all its varieties without any defenses. A tiny outflowing of love comfort, like a reflection of what she had poured into it, came from the other mote. Before Jessica could respond, she felt the adab presence of demanding memory. There was something that needed doing. She groped for it, realizing she was being impeded by a muzziness of the changed drug permeating her senses. I could change that, she thought. I could take away the drug action and make it harmless. But she sensed this would be an error. I'm within a right of joining. Then she knew what she had to do. Jessica opened her eyes, gestured to the water sack now being held above her by Cheney.
It has been blessed. Mingle the waters. Let the change come to all, that the people may partake and share in the blessing.
Let the catalyst do its work, she thought. Let the people drink of it and have their awareness of each other heightened for a while. The drug is safe now that a Reverend Mother has changed it. Still, the demanding memory worked on her, thrusting. There was another thing she had to do, she realized, but the drug made it difficult to focus. Ah, the old Reverend Mother.
I have met the Reverend Mother, Romalo. She is gone, but she remains. Let her memory be honored in the rite.
Now, where did I get those words? Jessica wondered. And she realized they came from another memory, the life that had been given to her and now was part of herself. Something about that gift felt incomplete, though.
Let them have their orgy. They've little enough pleasure out of living. Yes, and you and I need this little time to become acquainted before I recede and pour out through your memories. Already, I feel myself being tied to bits of you. Ah... You've a mind filled with interesting things. So many things I'd never imagined.
And the memory mind encapsulated within her opened itself to Jessica, permitting a view down a wide corridor to other Reverend Mothers until there seemed no end to them. Jessica recoiled, fearing she would become lost in an ocean of oneness. Still, the corridor remained, revealing to Jessica that the Fremen culture was far older than she had suspected. There had been Fremen on Porotrin, she saw, a people grown soft with an easy planet, fair game for Imperial raiders to harvest and plant human colonies on Beleteguz and Salusa Secundus. Oh, the wailing Jessica sensed in that parting. Far down the corridor, an image voice screamed, "They denied us the Hajj!" Jessica saw the slave cribs on Beleteguz down that inner corridor, saw the weeding out and the selecting that spread men to Rossak and Harmonthap. Scenes of brutal ferocity opened to her like the petals of a terrible flower, and she saw the thread of the past carried by Sayadina after Sayadina, first by word of mouth hidden in the sand shanties, then refined through their own reverent mothers with the discovery of the poison drug on Rosak, and now developed to subtle strength on Arrakis in the discovery of the water of life. Far down the inner corridor, another voice screamed, "Never to forgive! Never to forget!" But Jessica's attention was focused on the revelation of the water of life, seeing its source, the liquid exhalation of a dying sandworm, a maker. And as she saw the killing of it in her new memory, she suppressed a gasp. The creature was drowned.
"Mother, are you all right?"
Paul's voice intruded on her, and Jessica struggled out of the inner awareness to stare up at him, conscious of duty to him but resenting his presence. "I'm like a person whose hands were kept numb, without sensation from the first moment of awareness, until one day the ability to feel is forced into them." The thought hung in her mind, an enclosing awareness. "And I say, 'Look, I have no hands.' But the people all around me say, 'What are hands?'"
"Are you all right?"
"Yes."
"Is this all right for me to drink?"
He gestured to the sack in Chaney's hands.
"They want me to drink it."
She heard the hidden meaning in his words, realized he had detected the poison in the original unchanged substance, that he was concerned for her. It occurred to Jessica then to wonder about the limits of Paul's prescience. His question revealed much to her.
"You may drink it. It has been changed."
And she looked beyond him to see Stilgar staring down at her, the dark, dark eyes studying.
"No, we know you cannot be false."
She sensed hidden meaning here, too, but the muzziness of the drug was overpowering her senses. How warm it was, and soothing. How beneficent these Fremen to bring her into the fold of such companionship. Paul saw the drug take hold of his mother. He searched his memory, the fixed past, the flux lines of the possible futures. It was like scanning through arrested instants of time, disconcerting to the lens of the inner eye. The fragments were difficult to understand when snatched out of the flux. This drug, he could assemble knowledge about it, understand what it was doing to his mother, but the knowledge lacked a natural rhythm, lacked a system of mutual reflection. He realized suddenly that it was one thing to see the past occupying the present, but the true test of prescience was to see the past in the future. Things persisted in not being what they seemed.
"Drink it."
Chaney waved the horn spout of a water sack under his nose. Paul straightened, staring at Chaney. He felt carnival excitement in the air. He knew what would happen if he drank this spice drug with its quintessence of the substance that brought the change onto him. He would return to the vision of pure time, of time become space. It would perch him on the dizzying summit and defy him to understand. From behind Chaney, Stilgar spoke.
"Drink it, lad. You delay the rite."
Paul listened to the crowd then, hearing the wildness in their voices.
"Lisan al-Ghaib," they said. "Muad'Dib."
He looked down at his mother. She appeared peacefully asleep, in a sitting position, her breathing even and deep. A phrase out of the future that was his lonely past came into his mind. "She sleeps in the waters of life." Chaney tugged at his sleeve. Paul took the horn spout into his mouth, heard the people shout. He felt the liquid gush into his throat as Chaney pressed the sack, sensed giddiness in the fumes. Chaney removed the spout, handed the sack into hands that reached for it from the floor of the cavern, his eyes focused on her arm, the green band of mourning there. As she straightened, Chaney saw the direction of his gaze.
"I can mourn him even in the happiness of the waters. This was something he gave us."
She put her hand into his, pulling him along the ledge.
"We are alike in a thing, Usul. We have each lost a father to the Harkonnens."
Paul followed her. He felt that his head had been separated from his body and restored with odd connections. His legs were remote and rubbery. They entered a narrow side passage, its walls dimly lighted by spaced-out glow-globes. Paul felt the drug beginning to have its unique effect on him, opening time like a flower. He found need to steady himself against Chaney as they turned through another shadowed tunnel. The mixture of whipcord and softness he felt beneath her robe stirred his blood. The sensation mingled with the work of the drug, folding future and past into the present, leaving him the thinnest margin of trinocular focus.
I know you, Chaney. We've sat upon a ledge above the sand while I soothed your fears. We've caressed in the dark of the CH. We've...
Paul found himself losing focus, tried to shake his head, stumbled. Chaney steadied him, led him through thick hangings into the yellow warmth of a private apartment, low tables, cushions, a sleeping pad beneath an orange spread. Paul grew aware that they had stopped, that Chaney stood facing him, and that her eyes betrayed a look of quiet terror.
You must tell me.
You are Sihaya, the desert spring.
When the tribe shares the water, we're together, all of us. We share. I can sense the others with me, but I'm afraid to share with you.
Why?
He tried to focus on her, but past and future were merging into the present, blurring her image. He saw her in countless ways and positions and settings.
There's something frightening in you. When I took you away from the others, I did it because I could feel what the others wanted. You press on people. You make us see things.
What do you see?
Paul had forced himself to speak distinctly. She looked down at her hands.
I see a child in my arms. It's our child. Yours and mine.
Chaney put a hand to her mouth.
How can I know every feature of you?
They've a little of the talent, his mind told him. But they suppress it because it terrifies. In a moment of clarity, he saw how Chaney was trembling.
What is it you want to say?
Usul.
You cannot back into the future.
A profound compassion for her swept through him. He pulled her against him, stroked her head.
Chaney. Chaney, don't fear.
Usul, help me.
As she spoke, he felt the drug complete its work within him, ripping away the curtains to let him see the distant grey turmoil of his future.
You're so quiet.
He held himself poised in the awareness, seeing time stretch out in its weird dimension, delicately balanced yet whirling, narrow yet spread like a net, gathering countless worlds and forces, a tight wire that he must walk, yet a teeter-totter on which he balanced. On one side he could see the Imperium, a Harkonnen called Fade Rautha who flashed toward him like a deadly blade, the Sarduka raging off their planet to spread pogrom on Arrakis, the Guild conniving and plotting, the Bene Gesserit with their scheme of selective breeding. They lay, massed like a thunderhead on his horizon, held back by no more than the Fremen and their Muad'Dib. The sleeping giant Fremen, poised for their wild crusade across the universe. Paul felt himself at the center, at the pivot, where the whole structure turned, walking a thin wire of peace with a measure of happiness, Chaney at his side. He could see it stretching ahead of him, a time of relative quiet in a hidden siege, a moment of peace between periods of violence.
There's no other place for peace.
Usul, you're crying. Usul, my strength. Do you give moisture to the dead? To who's dead?
To ones not yet dead.
Then let them have their time of life.
He sensed through the drug fog how right she was. Pulled her against him with savage pressure.
Sihaya!
She put a palm against his cheek.
I'm no longer afraid, Usul. Look at me. I see what you see when you hold me thus.
What do you see?
I see us giving love to each other in a time of quiet between storms. It's what we were meant to do.
The drug had him again, and he thought, So many times you've given me comfort and forgetfulness. He felt anew the hyper-illumination with its high-relief imagery of time, sensed his future becoming memories, the tender indignities of physical love, the sharing and communion of selves, the softness and the violence.
You're the strong one, Chaney. Stay with me.
Always.
And she kissed his cheek. Book 3. The Prophet.
No woman, no man, no child ever was deeply intimate with my father. The closest anyone ever came to casual camaraderie with the Padishah Emperor was the relationship offered by Count Hasmir Fenring, a companion from childhood. The measure of Count Fenring's friendship may be seen first in a positive thing. He allayed the Landsrod's suspicions after the Arrakis affair. It cost more than 1 billion solaris in spice bribes, so my mother said, and there were other gifts as well, slave women, royal honors, and tokens of rank. The second major evidence of the Count's friendship was negative. He refused to kill a man even though it was within his capabilities, and my father commanded it. I will relate this presently. Count Fenring, a profile by the Princess Irulan.
The Baron Vladimir Harkonnen raged down the corridor from his private apartments, flitting through patches of late afternoon sunlight that poured down from high windows. He bobbed and twisted in his suspensors with violent movements. Past the private kitchen he stormed, past the library, past the small reception room, and into the servants' antechamber where the evening relaxation already had set in. The guard captain, Iokhan Nefud, squatted on a divan across the chamber, the stupor of Semuta dullness in his flat face, the eerie wailing of Semuta music around him. His own court sat near to do his bidding.
Nefud!
The baron roared. Men scrambled. Nefud stood, his face composed by the narcotic but with an overlay of paleness that told of his fear. The Semuta music had stopped.
"My Lord Baron,"
Nefud said. Only the drug kept the trembling out of his voice. The Baron scanned the faces around him, seeing the looks of frantic quiet in them. He returned his attention to Nefud and spoke in a silken tone.
"How long have you been my guard, Captain Nefud?"
Nefud swallowed. "Since Arrakis, my lord. Almost 2 years."
"And have you always anticipated dangers to my person?"
"Such has been my only desire, my lord."
"Then where is Fade Rotha?"
the baron roared. Nefud recoiled.
"Milord?" "You do not consider Fade Rotha a danger to my person?"
Again the voice was silken. Nefud wet his lips with his tongue. Some of the Semuta dullness left his eyes.
"Fade Rautha's in the slave quarters, my lord." "With the women again, eh?"
The baron trembled with the effort of suppressing anger.
"Sire, it could be his..." "Silence!"
The baron advanced another step into the antechamber, noting how the men moved back, clearing a subtle space around Nefud, dissociating themselves from the object of wrath.
"Did I not command you to know precisely where the Nar Baron was at all times?"
the baron asked. He moved a step closer.
"Did I not say to you that you were to know precisely what the Nar Baron was saying at all times? And to whom?"
Another step.
"Did I not say to you that you were to tell me whenever he went into the quarters of the slave women?"
Nefud swallowed. Perspiration stood out on his forehead. The baron held his voice flat, almost devoid of emphasis.
"Did I not say these things to you?"
Nefud nodded.
"And did I not say to you that you were to check all slave boys sent to me, and that you were to do this yourself, personally?"
Again Nefud nodded.
"Did you, perchance, not see the blemish on the thigh of the one sent me this evening?"
the baron asked.
"Is it possible, you..."
"Uncle!" The baron whirled, stared at Fade Rotha standing in the doorway. The presence of his nephew here, now, the look of hurry that the young man could not quite conceal, all revealed much. Fade Rather had his own spy system focused on the Baron.
"There is a body in my chambers that I wish removed,"
the Baron said, and he kept his hand at the projectile weapon beneath his robes, thankful that his shield was the best. Fade Rather glanced at two guardsmen against the right wall, nodded. The two detached themselves, scurried out the door and down the hall toward the Baron's apartments.
"Those two, eh?"
the Baron thought.
Ah, this young monster has much to learn yet about conspiracy. I presume you left matters peaceful in the slave quarters, Fade,
the Baron said.
I've been playing Cheops with the slave master,
Fade Rather said, and he thought, what has gone wrong? The boy we sent to my uncle has obviously been killed. But he was perfect for the job. Even Howard couldn't have made a better choice. The boy was perfect.
Playing pyramid chess,
the Baron said.
How nice. Did you win?
Yes, uncle.
And Fade Rather strove to contain his disquiet. The Baron snapped his fingers.
Nehud, you wish to be restored to my good graces?
Sire, what have I done? Nehud quavered.
That's unimportant now, the Baron said. Fade has beaten the slave master at Cheops. Did you hear that?
Yes, sire.
I wish you to take three men and go to the slave master,
the Baron said.
Garot, the slave master. Bring his body to me when you've finished, that I may see it was done properly. We cannot have such inept chess players in our employ.
Fade Rather went pale, took a step forward.
But, uncle, I...
Later, Fade,
the Baron said and waved a hand.
Later.
The two guards who had gone to the Baron's quarters for the slave boy's body staggered past the antechamber door with their load sagging between them, arms trailing. The Baron watched until they were out of sight.
Nehud stepped up beside the Baron. You'll wish me to kill the slave master now, my lord? Now,
the Baron said.
And when you've finished, add those two who just passed to your list. I don't like the way they carried that body. One should do such things neatly. I'll wish to see their carcasses, too.
Nehud said,
My lord, is it anything that I've...
Do as your master has ordered, Fade Rather said.
And he thought, All I can hope for now is to save my own skin. Good, the Baron thought. He yet knows how to cut his losses. And the Baron smiled inwardly at himself, thinking... The lad knows, too, what will please me and be most apt to stay my wrath from falling on him.
He knows I must preserve him. Who else do I have who could take the reins I must leave some day? I have no other as capable. But he must learn, and I must preserve myself while he's learning.
Nehud signaled men to assist him, led them out the door.
Would you accompany me to my chambers, Fade?
The Baron asked.
I am yours to command,
Fade Rather said. He bowed, thinking, I'm caught.
After you, the Baron said,
and he gestured to the door. Fade Rather indicated his fear by only the barest hesitation. Have I failed utterly? He asked himself. Will he slip a poisoned blade into my back, slowly, through the shield? Does he have an alternative successor?
Let him experience this moment of terror, the Baron thought, as he walked along behind his nephew. He will succeed me, but at a time of my choosing. I'll not have him throwing away what I've built.
Fade Rather tried not to walk too swiftly. He felt the skin crawling on his back, as though his body itself wondered when the blow could come. His muscles alternately tensed and relaxed.
Have you heard the latest word from Arrakis?
The Baron asked.
No, uncle.
Fade Rather forced himself not to look back. He turned down the hall out of the servants' wing.
They've a new prophet or religious leader of some kind among the Fremen,
the Baron said.
They call him Muad'Dib. Very funny, really. It means the mouse. I've told Raban to let them have their religion. It'll keep them occupied.
That's very interesting, uncle, Fade Rather said.
He turned into the private corridor to his uncle's quarters, wondering, why does he talk about religion? Is it some subtle hint to me?
Yes, isn't it? The Baron said.
They came into the Baron's apartments through the reception salon to the bedchamber. Subtle signs of a struggle greeted them here, a suspenser lamp displaced, a bed cushion on the floor, a soother reel spilled open across a bedstand.
It was a clever plan.
The Baron kept his body shield tuned to maximum, stopped, facing his nephew.
But not clever enough. Tell me, Fade, why didn't you strike me down yourself? You've had opportunity enough.
Fade Rautha found a suspensor chair, accomplished a mental shrug as he sat down in it without being asked. I must be bold now, he thought.
You taught me that my own hands must remain clean.
Ah, yes. When you face the Emperor, you must be able to say truthfully that you did not do the deed. The witch at the Emperor's elbow will hear your words and know their truth or falsehood. Yes, I warned you about that.
Why haven't you ever bought a Bene Gesserit, Uncle? With a truth-sayer at your side...
You know my tastes.
Fade Rautha studied his uncle.
Still, one would be valuable for...
I trust them not. And stop trying to change the subject.
As you wish, Uncle.
I remember a time in the arena several years ago. It seemed there, that day, a slave had been set to kill you. Is that truly how it was?
It's been so long ago, Uncle. After all, I...
No evasions, please.
Fade Rautha looked at his uncle, thinking, he knows, else he wouldn't ask.
It was a sham, Uncle. I arranged it to discredit your slave master.
Very clever. Brave, too. That slave gladiator almost took you, didn't he?
Yes.
If you had finesse and subtlety to match such courage, you'd be truly formidable.
The Baron shook his head from side to side. As he had done many times since that terrible day on Arrakis, he found himself regretting the loss of Piter the Mentat. There had been a man of delicate, devilish subtlety. It hadn't saved him, though. Again, the Baron shook his head. Fate was sometimes inscrutable. Fade Rautha glanced around the bedchamber, studying the signs of the struggle, wondering how his uncle had overcome the slave they'd prepared so carefully.
How did I best him? Ah, now, Fade, let me keep some weapons to preserve me in my old age. It's better we use this time to strike a bargain.
Fade Rautha stared at him.
A bargain? He means to keep me as his heir for certain, then. Else why bargain? One bargains with equals, or near equals.
What bargain, Uncle?
And Fade Rautha felt proud that his voice remained calm and reasonable, betraying none of the elation that filled him. The Baron, too, noted the control. He nodded.
You're good material, Fade. I don't waste good material. You persist, however, in refusing to learn my true value to you. You are obstinate. You do not see why I should be preserved as someone of the utmost value to you. This...
He gestured at the evidence of the struggle in the bedchamber.
This was foolishness. I do not reward foolishness.
Get to the point, you old fool, Fade Rautha thought.
You think of me as an old fool. I must dissuade you of that.
You speak of a bargain.
Ah, the impatience of youth. Well, this is the substance of it, then. You will cease these foolish attempts on my life, and I, when you are ready for it, will step aside in your favor. I will retire to an advisory position, leaving you in the seat of power.
Retire, Uncle?
You still think me the fool, and this but confirms it, eh? You think I'm begging you? Step cautiously, Fade. This old fool saw through the shielded needle you planted in that slave boy's thigh. Right where I put my hand on it, eh? The smallest pressure and... snick! A poison needle in the old fool's palm. Ah, Fade.
The Baron shook his head, thinking, it would have worked too if Howard hadn't warned me. Well, let the lad believe I saw the plot on my own. In a way, I did. I was the one who saved Howard from the wreckage of Arrakis. and this lad needs greater respect for my prowess. Fade Rautha remained silent, struggling with himself. Is he being truthful? Does he really mean to retire? Why not? I'm sure to succeed him one day if I move carefully. He can't live forever. Perhaps it was foolish to try hurrying the process.
You speak of a bargain. What pledge do we give to bind it?
How can we trust each other, eh? Well, Fade, as for you, I'm setting Thufir Hawat to watch over you. I trust Hawat's Mentat capabilities in this. Do you understand me? And as for me, you'll have to take me on faith. But I can't live forever, can I, Fade? And perhaps you should begin to suspect now that there are things I know which you should know.
I give you my pledge. And what do you give me?
I let you go on living.
Again, Fade Rautha studied his uncle. He sets Hawat over me. What would he say if I told him Hawat planned the trick with the gladiator that cost him his slave master? He'd likely say I was lying in the attempt to discredit Hawat. No, the good Thufir is a Mentat and has anticipated this moment.
Well, what do you say?
What can I say? I accept, of course.
And Fade Rautha thought, Hawat, he plays both ends against the middle. Is that it? Has he moved to my uncle's camp because I didn't counsel with him over the slave boy attempt?
You haven't said anything about my setting Hawat to watch you.
Fade Rautha betrayed anger by a flaring of nostrils. The name of Hawat had been a danger signal in the Harkonnen family for so many years, and now it had a new meaning. Still dangerous.
Hawat's a dangerous toy.
Toy? Don't be stupid. I know what I have in Hawat, and how to control it. Hawat has deep emotions, Fade. The man without emotions is the one to fear, but deep emotions, now those can be bent to your needs.
Uncle, I don't understand you.
Yes, that's plain enough.
Only a flicker of eyelids betrayed the passage of resentment through Fade Rautha.
And you do not understand Hawat?
Nor do you, Fade Rautha thought.
Who does Hawat blame for his present circumstances? Me? Certainly. But he was an Atreides tool and bested me for years until the Imperium took a hand. That's how he sees it. His hate for me is a casual thing now. He believes he can best me any time. Believing this, he is bested. For I direct his attention where I want it. Against the Imperium.
Tensions of a new understanding drew tight lines across Fade Rautha's forehead, thinned his mouth.
Against the Emperor?
Let my dear nephew try the taste of that, the Baron thought. Let him say to himself, the Emperor Fade Rautha Harkonnen. Let him ask himself how much that's worth. Surely it must be worth the life of one old uncle who could make that dream come to pass. Slowly, Fade Rautha wet his lips with his tongue. Could it be true what the old fool was saying? There was more here than there seemed to be.
And what has Hawat to do with this?
He thinks he uses us to wreak his revenge upon the Emperor.
And when that's accomplished?
He does not think beyond his revenge. Hawat's a man who must serve others, and doesn't even know this about himself.
I've learned much from Hawat.
Fade Rautha felt the truth of the words as he spoke them.
But the more I learn, the more I feel we should dispose of him, and soon.
You don't like the idea of his watching you?
Hawat watches everybody.
And he may put you on a throne. Hawat is subtle, he is dangerous, devious. But I'll not yet withhold the antidote from him. A sword is dangerous too, Fade. We have the scabbard for this one, though. The poison's in him. When we withdraw the antidote, death will sheathe him.
In a way, it's like the arena. Feints within feints within feints. You watch to see which way the gladiator leans, which way he looks, how he holds his knife.
He nodded to himself, seeing that these words pleased his uncle, but thinking, yes, like the arena, and the cutting edge is the mind.
Now you see you need me. I'm yet of use, Fade.
A sword to be wielded until he's too blunt for use, Fade Rautha thought.
Yes, Uncle.
And now we will go down to the slave quarters, we two, and I will watch while you, with your own hands, kill all the women in the pleasure wing.
Uncle?
There will be other women, Fade. But I have said that you do not make a mistake casually with me.
Fade Rauther's face darkened.
Uncle, you...
You will accept your punishment and learn something from it.
Fade Rauther met the gloating stare in his uncle's eyes. And I must remember this night, he thought. And remembering it, I must remember other nights.
You will not refuse.
What could you do if I refused, old man? Fade Rauther asked himself. But he knew there might be some other punishment, perhaps a more subtle one, a more brutal lever to bend him.
I know you, Fade. You will not refuse.
All right, Fade Rauther thought. I need you now. I see that. The bargain's made. But I'll not always need you. And someday...
Deep in the human unconscious is a pervasive need for a logical universe that makes sense. But the real universe is always one step beyond logic. From Sayings of the Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
I've sat across from many rulers of great houses, but never seen a more gross and dangerous pig than this one, Thufir Hawat told himself.
You may speak plainly with me, Hawat,
the Baron rumbled.
He leaned back in his suspensor chair, the eyes in their folds of fat boring into Hawat. The old Mentat looked down at the table between him and the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen, noting the opulence of its grain. Even this was a factor to consider in assessing the Baron, as were the red walls of this private conference room, and the faint, sweet herb scent that hung on the air, masking a deeper musk.
"You didn't have me send that warning to Rabban as an idle whim," the Baron said.
Hawat's leathery old face remained impassive, betraying none of the loathing he felt.
"I suspect many things, my lord,"
he said.
"Yes. Well, I wish to know how Arrakis figures in your suspicions about Seleucia Secundus. It is not enough that you say to me the Emperor is in a ferment about some association between Arrakis and his mysterious prison planet. Now, I rushed the warning out to Rabban only because a courier had to leave on that highliner. You said there could be no delay. Well and good. But now I will have an explanation."
He babbles too much, Hawat thought. He's not like Leto, who could tell me a thing with the lift of an eyebrow or the wave of a hand, nor like the old Duke, who could express an entire sentence in the way he accented a single word.
This is a clod. Destroying him will be a service to mankind.
You will not leave here until I've had a full and complete explanation, the Baron said.
You speak too casually of Seleucia Secundus, Hawat said.
It's a penal colony, the Baron said. The worst riff-raff in the galaxy are sent to Seleucia Secundus. What else do we need to know?
That conditions on the prison planet are more oppressive than anywhere else, Hawat said. You hear that the mortality rate among new prisoners is higher than 60%. You hear that the Emperor practices every form of oppression there. You hear all this, and do not ask questions.
"The Emperor doesn't permit the great houses to inspect his prison," the Baron growled. "But he hasn't seen into my dungeons, either."
"And curiosity about Seleucia Secundus is,
Hawat put a bony finger to his lips.
"Discouraged.
So he's not proud of some of the things he must do there."
Hawat allowed the faintest of smiles to touch his dark lips. His eyes glinted in the glow-tube light as he stared at the Baron.
"And you've never wondered where the Emperor gets his Sarduka?"
The Baron pursed his fat lips. This gave his features the look of a pouting baby, and his voice carried a tone of petulance as he said,
"Why, he recruits. That is to say, there are the levies, and he enlists from..."
"Fah!" Howard snapped.
"The stories you hear about the exploits of the Sarduka, they're not rumours, are they? Those are first-hand accounts from the limited number of survivors who fought against the Sarduka, eh?"
"The Sarduka are excellent fighting men, no doubt of it," the Baron said. "But I think my own legions, A pack of holiday excursionists, by comparison,
Howard snarled.
You think I don't know why the Emperor turned against House Atreides?
This is not a realm open to your speculation,
the Baron warned. Is it possible that even he doesn't know what motivated the Emperor in this? Howard asked himself.
Any area is open to my speculation if it does what you've hired me to do,
Howard said.
I am a Mentat. You do not withhold information or computation lines from a Mentat.
For a long minute, the Baron stared at him. Then,
say what you must say, Mentat.
The Padishah Emperor turned against House Atreides because the Duke's War Masters, Gurney Haddock and Duncan Idaho, had trained a fighting force, a small fighting force, to within a hair as good as the Sardaukar. Some of them were even better. And the Duke was in a position to enlarge his force, to make it every bit as strong as the Emperor's.
The Baron weighed this disclosure. Then,
what has Arrakis to do with this?
It provides a pool of recruits, already conditioned to the bitterest survival training.
The Baron shook his head.
You cannot mean the Fremen.
I mean the Fremen.
Ha! Then why warn Rabban? There cannot be more than a handful of Fremen left after the Sardaukar pogrom and Rabban's oppression.
Hawat continued to stare at him silently.
Not more than a handful,
the Baron repeated.
Rabban killed 6,000 of them last year alone.
Still, Howard stared at him.
And the year before it was 9,000,
the Baron said.
And before they left, the Sardaukar must have accounted for at least 20,000.
What are Rabban's troop losses for the past 2 years?
Howard asked. The Baron rubbed his jowls.
Well, he has been recruiting rather heavily, to be sure. His agents make rather extravagant promises, and
shall we say 30,000 in round numbers?
Howard asked.
That would seem a little high,
the Baron said.
Quite the contrary,
Howard said.
I can read between the lines of Rabban's reports as well as you can, and you certainly must have understood my reports from our agents.
Arrakis is a fierce planet,
the Baron said.
Storm losses can—
We both know the figure for storm accretion, Howard said.
What if he has lost 30,000?
The Baron demanded, and blood darkened his face.
By your own count, Howard said, he killed 15,000 over 2 years, while losing twice that number.
You say the Sardaukar accounted for another 20,000, possibly a few more, and I've seen the transportation manifests for their return from Arrakis. If they killed 20,000, they lost almost 5-for-1.
Why won't you face these figures, Baron, and understand what they mean?
The Baron spoke in a coldly measured cadence.
This is your job, Mentat. What do they mean?
I gave you Duncan Idaho's headcount on the Sietch he visited,
Howard said.
It all fits. If they had just 250 such Sietch communities, their population would be about 5 million. My best estimate is that they had at least twice that many communities. You scatter your population on such a planet.
10 million?
The Baron's jowls quivered with amazement.
At least.
The Baron pursed his fat lips. The beady eyes stared without wavering at Howard.
Is this true, Mentat computation?
He wondered.
How could this be and no one suspect?
We haven't even cut heavily into their birth rate growth figure,
Howard said.
We've just weeded out some of their less successful specimens, leaving the strong to grow stronger, just like on Seleucus Secundus.
Seleucus Secundus,
the Baron barked.
What has this to do with the Emperor's prison planet?
The man who survives Seleucus Secundus starts out being tougher than most others,
Howard said.
When you add the very best of military training...
Nonsense! By your argument, I could recruit from among the Fremen after the way they've been oppressed by my nephew.
Howard spoke in a mild voice.
Don't you oppress any of your troops?
Well, I... but...
Oppression is a relative thing,
Howard said.
Your fighting men are much better off than those around them, hey? They see unpleasant alternative to being soldiers of the Baron, hey?
The Baron fell silent, eyes unfocused. The possibilities. Had Rabban unwittingly given House Harkonnen its ultimate weapon? Presently he said,
How could you be sure of the loyalty of such recruits?
I would take them in small groups, not larger than platoon strength, Howard said. I'd remove them from their oppressive situation and isolate them with a training cadre of people who understood their background. Preferably people who had preceded them from the same oppressive situation. Then I'd fill them with the mystique that their planet had really been a secret training ground to produce just such superior beings as themselves. And all the while I'd show them what such superior beings could earn. Rich living, beautiful women, fine mansions, whatever they desired.
The Baron began to nod.
The way the Sardauka live at home.
The recruits come to believe in time that such a place as Seleucus Secundus is justified because it produced them, the elite. The commonest Sardauka trooper lives a life, in many respects, as exalted as that of any member of a great house.
Such an idea, the Baron whispered.
You begin to share my suspicions, Howard said.
Where did such a thing start? The Baron asked.
Ah, yes. Where did House Carino originate? Were there people on Seleucus Secundus before the Emperor sent his first contingents of prisoners there? Even the Duke Leto, a cousin on the Distaff side, never knew for sure. Such questions are not encouraged.
The Baron's eyes glazed with thought.
Yes, a very carefully kept secret. They'd used every device of...
Besides, what's there to conceal? Howard asked. That the Padishah Emperor has a prison planet? Everyone knows this. That he has...
Count Fenring,
the Baron blurted. Howard broke off, studied the Baron with a puzzled frown.
What of Count Fenring?
At my nephew's birthday, several years ago, the Baron said. This imperial popinjay, Count Fenring, came as official observer and to... conclude a business arrangement between the Emperor and myself.
So?
During one of our conversations, I believe I said something about making a prison planet of Arrakis. Fenring...
What did you say exactly? Howard asked.
Exactly? That was quite a while ago, and...
My Lord Baron, if you wish to make the best use of my services, you must give me adequate information. Wasn't this conversation recorded?
The Baron's face darkened with anger.
You're as bad as Piter. I don't like these...
Piter is no longer with you, my lord,
Howard said.
As to that, whatever did happen to Piter?
He became too familiar, too demanding of me,
the Baron said.
You assure me you don't waste a useful man,
Howard said.
Will you waste me by threats and quibbling? We were discussing what you said to Count Fenring.
Slowly the Baron composed his features.
When the time comes, he thought, I'll remember his manner with me. Yes, I will remember. One moment,
the Baron said, and he thought back to the meeting in his great hall. It helped to visualize the cone of silence in which they had stood.
I said something like this, the Baron said. The Emperor knows a certain amount of killing has always been an arm of business. I was referring to our workforce losses. Then I said something about considering another solution to the Arrakeen problem, and I said the Emperor's prison planet inspired me to emulate him.
Witch blood,
Howard snapped.
What did Fenring say?
That's when he began questioning me about you.
Howard sat back, closed his eyes in thought.
So that's why they started looking into Arrakis,
he said.
Well, the thing's done.
He opened his eyes.
They must have spies all over Arrakis by now. 2 years.
But certainly my innocent suggestion that...
Nothing is innocent in an emperor's eyes. What were your instructions to Raban?
Merely that he should teach Arrakis to fear us.
Howard shook his head.
You now have two alternatives, Baron. You can kill off the natives, wipe them out entirely, or...
Waste an entire workforce?
Would you prefer to have the Emperor and those great houses he can still swing behind him come in here and perform a curetment? Scrape out Gede Prime like a hollow gourd?
The Baron studied his mentat, then...
He wouldn't dare.
Wouldn't he?
The Baron's lips quivered.
What is your alternative?
Abandon your dear nephew, Raban.
The Baron broke off, stared at Howard.
Send him no more troops, no aid of any kind. Don't answer his messages other than to say you've heard of the terrible way he's handled things on Arrakis, and you intend to take corrective measures as soon as you're able. I'll arrange to have some of your messages intercepted by Imperial spies.
But what are the spies? The revenues, the
demands, your baronial profits, but be careful how you make your demands. Require fixed sums of Raban. We can...
The Baron turned his hands palm up.
But how can I be certain that my weasel nephew isn't...
We still have our spies on Arrakis. Tell Raban he either meets the spice quotas you set him or he'll be replaced.
I know my nephew, the Baron said. This would only make him oppress the population even more.
Of course he will,
Howard snapped.
You don't want that stopped now. You merely want your own hands clean. Let Raban make your Seleucus Secundus for you. There's no need even to send him any prisoners. He has all the population required. If Raban is driving his people to meet your spice quotas, then the Emperor need suspect no other motive. That's reason enough for putting the planet on the rack. And you, Baron, will not show by word or action that there's any other reason for this.
The Baron could not keep the sly tone of admiration out of his voice.
Ah, Howard, you are a devious one. Now, how do we move into Arrakis and make use of what Raban prepares?
That's the simplest thing of all, Baron. If you set each year's quota a bit higher than the one before, matters will soon reach a head there. Production will drop off. You can remove Raban and take over yourself, to correct the mess.
It fits, the Baron said. But I can feel myself tiring of all this. I'm preparing another to take over Arrakis for me.
Hawat studied the fat, round face across from him. Slowly the old soldier spy began to nod his head.
Fade Rauther,
he said.
So that's the reason for the oppression now. You're very devious yourself, Baron. Perhaps we can incorporate these two schemes. Yes. Your Fade Rauther can go to Arrakis as their saviour. He can win the populace, yes.
The Baron smiled, and behind his smile he asked himself, now, how does this fit in with Howard's personal scheming? And Howard, seeing that he was dismissed, arose and left the red-walled room. As he walked, he could not put down the disturbing unknowns that cropped into every computation about Arrakis. This new religious leader that Gurney Halleck hinted at from his hiding place among the smugglers, this Muad'Dib.
Perhaps I should not have told the Baron to let this religion flourish where it will, even among the folk of Pan and Graben, he told himself. But it's well known that repression makes the religion flourish.
And he thought about Halleck's reports on Fremen battle tactics. The tactics smacked of Halleck himself, and Idaho, and even of Howard.
Did Idaho survive?
He asked himself. But this was a futile question. He did not yet ask himself if it was possible that Paul had survived. He knew the Baron was convinced that all Atreides were dead. The Bene Gesserit witch had been his weapon, the Baron admitted, and that could only mean an end to all, even to the woman's own son. What a poisonous hate she must have had for the Atreides, he thought. Something like the hate I hold for this Baron. Will my blow be as final and complete as hers?
There is in all things a pattern that is part of our universe. It has symmetry, elegance, and grace. Those qualities you find always in that which the true artist captures. You can find it in the turning of the seasons, in the way sand trails along a ridge, in the branch clusters of the creosote bush, or the pattern of its leaves. We try to copy these patterns in our lives and our society, seeking the rhythms, the dances, the forms that comfort. Yet it is possible to see peril in the finding of ultimate perfection. It is clear that the ultimate pattern contains its own fixity. In such perfection, all things move toward death. From the collected sayings of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
Hall Muad'Dib remembered that there had been a meal heavy with spice essence. He clung to this memory because it was an anchor point, and he could tell himself from this vantage that his immediate experience must be a dream.
I am a theatre of processes,
he told himself. I am a prey to the imperfect vision, to the race consciousness and its terrible purpose. Yet he could not escape the fear that he had somehow overrun himself, lost his position in time, so that past and future and present mingled without distinction. It was a kind of visual fatigue, and it came, he knew, from the constant necessity of holding the prescient future as a kind of memory that was in itself a thing intrinsically of the past. Cheney prepared the meal for me, he told himself. Yet Cheney was deep in the south, in the cold country where the sun was hot, secreted in one of the new Sietch strongholds, safe with their son, Leto the Second. Or was that a thing yet to happen? No, he reassured himself, for Alia the Strange One, his sister, had gone there with his mother and with Cheney, a 20-thumper trip into the south, riding a reverend mother's palanquin fixed to the back of a wild maker. He shied away from the thought of riding the giant worms, asking himself, what is Alia yet to be born?
I was on Arazia, Paul recalled. I went raiding to recover the water of our dead in Arakeen, and I found the remains of my father in the funeral pyre. I enshrined the skull of my father in a Fremen rock mound overlooking Harg Pass.
Or was that a thing yet to be?
My wounds are real, Paul told himself. My scars are real. The shrine of my father's skull is real.
Still in the dreamlike state, Paul remembered that Hera, Jameis's wife, had intruded on him once to say there'd been a fight in the Sietch corridor. That had been the interim Sietch before the women and children had been sent into the deep south. Hera had stood there in the entrance to the inner chamber, the black wings of her hair tied back by water rings on a chain. She had held aside the chamber's hangings and told him that Cheney had just killed someone.
This happened, Paul told himself. This was real, not born out of its time and subject to change.
Paul remembered he had rushed out to find Cheney standing beneath the yellow globes of the corridor, clad in a brilliant blue wraparound robe with hood thrown back, a flush of exertion on her elfin features. She had been sheathing her kris knife. A huddled group had been hurrying away down the corridor with a burden. And Paul remembered telling himself, you always know when they're carrying a body. Cheney's water rings, worn openly in Sietch on a cord around her neck, tinkled as she turned toward him.
Cheney, what is this? He asked. I dispatched one who came to challenge you in single combat, Ussul. You killed him? Yes, but perhaps I should have left him for Hera.
And Paul recalled how the faces of the people around them had showed appreciation for these words. Even Hera had laughed.
But he came to challenge me. You trained me yourself in the weirding way, Ussul. Certainly, but you shouldn't. I was born in the desert, Ussul. I know how to use a kris knife.
He suppressed his anger, tried to talk reasonably.
This may all be true, Cheney, but
I am no longer a child hunting scorpions in the Sietch by the light of a hand globe, Ussul. I do not play games.
Paul glared at her, caught by the odd ferocity beneath her casual attitude.
He was not worthy, Ussul, Cheney said. I'd not disturb your meditations with the likes of him.
She moved closer, looking at him out of the corners of her eyes, dropping her voice so that only he might hear.
And, beloved, when it's learned that a challenger may face me and be brought to shameful death by Muad'Dib's woman, there'll be fewer challengers.
Yes, Paul told himself, that has certainly happened. It was true past, and the number of challengers testing the new blade of Muad'Dib did drop dramatically.
Somewhere, in a world not of the dream, there was a hint of motion, the cry of a night bird.
I dream, Paul reassured himself. It's the spice meal.
Still, there was about him a feeling of abandonment. He wondered if it might be possible that his true spirit had slipped over somehow into the world where the Fremen believed he had his true existence, into the Alam al-Mithal, the world of similitudes, that metaphysical realm where all physical limitations were removed. and he knew fear at the thought of such a place, because removal of all limitations meant removal of all points of reference. In the landscape of a myth, he could not orient himself and say, "I am I, because I am here." His mother had once said, "The people are divided, some of them, in how they think of you." "I must be waking from the dream," Paul told himself. For this had happened. These words from his mother, the Lady Jessica, who was now a reverend mother of the Fremen, these words had passed through reality. Jessica was fearful of the religious relationship between himself and the Fremen, Paul knew. She didn't like the fact that people of both Sietch and Graben referred to Muad'Dib as him, and she went questioning among the tribes, sending out her Sayadina spies, collecting their answers and brooding on them. She had quoted a Bene Gesserit proverb to him, "When religion and politics travel in the same cart, the riders believe nothing can stand in their way. Their movement becomes headlong, faster and faster and faster. They put aside all thought of obstacles and forget that a precipice does not show itself to a man in a blind rush until it's too late."